After Sally stopped in front of Lucy's Dress Emporium, Smoke rode on down to Longmont's and went inside. As was his custom upon entering any saloon, he stepped immediately to the side and pressed his back up against the wall. He stood there a moment, letting his eyes adjust to the lower light inside while he looked for possible trouble among the patrons. Even though he knew he was almost as safe in his friend's restaurant as he was in his own house, he'd been hunted and tracked for more than half his life, and the habit of caution was so ingrained in him that when he was cautious, he didn't even notice it. The owner of the saloon and restaurant, Lewis Longmont, was sitting at his usual table in a corner. He smiled as he watched his friend go through his regular ritual. Lewis was a lean, hawk-faced man with strong, slender hands, long fingers, and carefully manicured nails. He had jet-black hair and a black, pencil-thin mustache. He was dressed in a black suit with white shirt and a crimson ascot. He wore low-heeled boots and a pistol that hung in tied-down leather on his right side. The pistol was nickel-plated with ivory handles, but it wasn't just for show, for Lewis was snake-quick and a feared, deadly gun hand when pushed. Although Lewis was engaged in a profession that didn't have a very good reputation, he wasn't an evil man. He had never hired his gun out for money. And while he could make a deck of cards do almost anything, he had never cheated at poker. He didn't have to cheat. He was possessed of a phenomenal memory, could tell you the odds of filling any type of poker hand, and was an expert at the technique of card counting. Lewis was just past 30. When he was a small boy, he left Louisiana and came west with his parents. They had died in a shantytown fire, leaving the boy to cope as best he could. Lewis had coped quite well, parlaying his innate intelligence and willingness to take a chance into a fortune. He owned a large ranch up in Wyoming territory, several businesses in San Francisco, and a hefty chunk of a railroad. Still standing just inside the door, Smoke glanced over and saw his friend smiling at him. He returned the grin, then moved across the floor to take a seat at Lewis's table. Lewis was shuffling a deck of cards and dealing poker hands. He turned up three hands, studied them for a moment, then pointed to the hand that was still face down.
If I were a betting man, and incidentally I am, I would bet on this as the winning hand.
What makes you think so? This one has a pair of aces.
I think this will have three of a kind. Small cards, to be sure, but three will beat a pair of aces.
He turned up the cards to expose three sixes, a jack, and a queen.
I'm glad I didn't bet.
Did Miss Sally remain behind at Sugarloaf?
No, Sally came with me. She'll be here shortly.
Ah, good, good. I'm always glad to see you, my friend, but the lovely Mademoiselle Sally, it is well known that her beauty brings joy to a dreary world.
Do I have to keep reminding you, Lewis, that Sally is not we're married, Lewis.
Yes, mon ami, I know you're married, but le poids est éternel. Hope is eternal.
Sheriff Carson came into the saloon.
Have I missed a joke?
Alas, my gendarme friend, the joke is on me.
How about a round of beers on me? I'm heading down to Frisco and could use one for the trail.
Why Frisco?
Lewis signaled to the bartender to bring three beers.
I'm going there to meet a cattle buyer named Davenport. Turns out he has a contract to supply beef to the army, and I figure he's going to be in the market.
But can't you sell your beef here to C.D. Montgomery or one of the other buyers?
I could, but Davenport is paying more, providing I deliver the cattle to the railhead in Frisco.
I see. Do you think he'll pay enough to make it worth your while to take your cattle to Frisco?
I think he will. At least that's what I intend to find out with this trip.
That sounds smart to me. No wonder Sugarloaf is the most successful ranch around. You are always on top of things.
Don't give me credit for this. This was all Sally's idea.
Yes, I know. She's not only beautiful, she's very smart. Ah, what a woman.
Oh, say, Smoke, you remember a fella by the name of Van Arnt? Reese Van Arnt?
Yeah, I remember him. As I recall, he tried to hold up a train a few years ago.
As you recall, tried is right. He tried, but he didn't succeed because of you, my friend. His gang was killed and he wound up going to prison.
Good place for him.
I would agree with you. Unfortunately, he is no longer there. I got a wire a few days ago from Warden Parker at the prison.
Don't tell me. Van Art has escaped.
He didn't escape. He was let out. He served his time and is now a free man. The warden thought you might like to know that.
Why would he think of that? Has Van Art made any specific threats?
I don't know, and Warden Parker didn't say. All I know is that his telegram just said that I should advise you that Van Art has served his time and has been released. If you want to know the truth, I expect Parker's just being extra cautious is all.
Well, I don't fault him for his caution, and I appreciate you bringing me the information. I've had a passel of people after me in my life, so if somebody new is added to the bunch that call themselves my enemy, it's always good to know his name.
Smoke Jensen, let's see just how good you really are with a gun. I'm calling you out, you son of a bitch.
Looking toward the sound of the voice, Smoke saw Lucas Keno standing just inside the door. There was an expression of rage and hatred on the cowboy's face, and he was holding a pistol leveled at Smoke.
What are you doing, Keno?
Cal and Pearly have both told me that you're the best with a pistol they ever saw. So, I'm just wondering how good you really are. Because, you see, I'm pretty good myself. What I thought is, we just see which one of us is the best in a fair fight.
It's hardly a fair fight when you're already holding a gun in your hand.
Well, now, you see, the way I look at it, that's what it's going to take to make it a fair fight. I figure if you really are as good as old Cal and Pearly say you are, then I might just need me an advantage.
Well, that's quite an advantage, Keno. In fact, it is so much an advantage that if, by some wild chance, you would happen to kill Smoke, or anyone else in here, it would be considered murder in the first degree. We hang people for that in this state.
Yeah, I reckon it is a big advantage, ain't it? Tell you what I'll do for you, Jensen. I'll give you a chance to stand up and face me, and I won't shoot until I see you start to pull your gun.
Smoke smiled, and the smile was broad and genuine.
You smiling at, you son of a bitch. Don't you understand what's going on here?
Now Sheriff Carson and Longmont were smiling as well.
Have you all gone crazy? I'm the one holding the gun here, or ain't you people noticed that?
Oh, we've noticed all right. Drop the gun, Keno. Drop the gun, and you might live.
What are you talking about? Why would I do a foolish thing like that?
Because if you don't drop your gun right now, I will be forced to put a .32 caliber ball in your head.
Hi, Sally. Do you want a beer?
Don't mind if I do. Lewis, tell Andrew to draw one for me while I shoot Mr. Keno in the back of his head for not dropping his pistol when I told him to.
No, I'm dropping it. I'm dropping it. Don't shoot.
Damn. I walked all the way down here. Now I have to put Keno in jail before I can even have a beer.
Darling, pick up Keno's gun and bring it to me.
Stepping around Keno, Sally reached down to pick up his pistol. Then she took it over to the table. The wooden pistol grip was still shattered from the impact of the bullet when Smoke had shot it a few days earlier. Smoke held it out toward Keno.
Damn, you haven't gotten that fixed yet? I thought you were supposed to be so all-fired good with a gun. Nobody who's good with a gun would let one stay in such bad condition as this.
Smoke removed the cylinder and slipped it into his pocket. Then, using his pocket knife, he extracted the firing pin. After that, he walked over and dropped the gun into a half-full spittoon.
No need to put him in jail, Sheriff. He didn't actually do anything.
Smoke handed the empty cylinder to Carson.
Suppose you hold on to this for a couple of days, though.
All right.
You don't have to be doing me no damn favors.
Oh, don't get me wrong, Keno. I'm not doing you any favors. I'm just telling you straight out to get out of my sight. And stay out of my sight. Because next time I see you, I'll kill you.
What? Well, Sheriff, did you hear that? This man just threatened to kill me.
Yes, I heard the man. Get out of here now before I kill you myself.
I ain't going nowhere without my pistol.
Carson pointed to the spittoon where Smoke had deposited Keno's pistol.
There it is. Fish it out and it's yours.
Keno walked over to the spittoon, looked down into it, hesitated for a moment, then, making a face of disgust and revulsion, stuck his hand down into the little brass pot. A few seconds later, he pulled his pistol without the cylinder out, and with the gun and his hand both dripping a brown, slimy, oozing liquid, he walked quickly out of the saloon. It was late afternoon when Tucker, Rawlins, and Clay rode into Frisco. They'd purposely chosen this time because they figured that the nearer to closing time it was when they held up the bank, the fewer chances there would be for any of the citizens of the town to be present. Also, by the end of the day, the tellers would be tired and less responsive, which should make the outlaws' job easier. The three men were wearing long white dusters and hats that were pulled low. Dismounting about half a block away from the bank, they stood there for a moment, looking up and down the street.
Anyone see anything that looks unusual?
Looks normal to me.
See any law?
No, no law.
All right, Rawlins. You wait here with the horses. When you see us come out of the bank, you bring the horses up to us fast. You understand me? Because I swear, if you ain't in front of the bank by the time we reach the street, I'll shoot you myself.
I'll be there.
You'd better be.
Tucker looked over at Clay and nodded.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Then let's go.
Tucker and Clay moved down to the front of the bank, looked up and down the street, then at each other. Tucker nodded. Then the two men pulled their bandanas up to cover their faces and stepped into the bank. In addition to the two tellers, there were two customers in the bank. A woman who was in front of one of the teller windows, and a man who was standing at the table filling out a deposit slip.
Everybody put your hands in the air!
Oh my God, it's a bank robbery!
You, put all the money in this bag!
Tucker handed the teller a cloth bag, and he started scooping money up from the cash drawer.
From the safe!
The safe? There's no money in the safe.
Mr. Bank Teller, I know that there is $100,000 in the safe, and I am going to kill this man right now unless you empty the safe like I told you to.
The teller took the bag, then walked to the back of the bank, where there sat a large safe that was black with gold trim. Opening the safe, George began filling the sack with bound stacks of bills. It took but a moment to empty the safe. Then he brought the bag back and handed it to Tucker.
Very good. Let's go.
As the two men started out of the bank, the one male customer drew a gun from somewhere. Neither Tucker nor Clay had noticed it when they came into the bank because the customer wasn't wearing a holster.
Drop that money!
Tucker and Clay dashed outside, both of them turning to fire back toward the bank as they left.
Rawlins! Where the hell's Rawlins? That son of a bitch is supposed to be here!
Here he comes.
Rawlins was approaching him at a rapid trot, leading two more horses.
Did you get the money?
Yeah.
$100,000, son of a bitch! $100,000!
Shoot!
At what?
At the town! Shoot up the town! Get everyone off the street!
Smoke Jensen had just ridden into town. Several gunshots erupted from down at the far end of the street. He immediately put himself right in the action. He didn't have to wonder what the sound was, because he had heard that sound many times over the last two decades of his life. Smoke was being shot at, and one bullet had come within inches of his head. He saw all three of the bank robbers bearing down on him, their dusters flying in the wind behind them. He sat his saddle for what, to onlookers, appeared to be an agonizingly long moment. Then, as calmly as someone retrieving an umbrella, Smoke pulled his Winchester from the saddle holster just in front of his right leg. Methodically, he jacked a shell into the chamber, raised his rifle to his shoulder, almost leisurely, and aimed at the bank robber who was riding in the middle.
Damn, look at that crazy son of a bitch. Why don't he move?
He's gonna get himself killed is what he's gonna do.
The robber fell from the saddle. The second robber fell as well, but this one didn't fall as cleanly as the first because his foot got hung up in the stirrup and he was dragged through the dirt for several feet before his foot came loose. Smoke's action had not only alerted but inspired some of the other townspeople because the third robber was brought down by a fusillade of bullets, not one of which had been fired by Smoke. The third robber had been carrying a cloth bag and it fell with him. As it did so, several of the bound bundles of bills spilled out into the street. Almost before the echoes of the gunshots had died down, people began coming out into the streets, many of them armed. Cautiously, they approached the three men who were sprawled out in the street. A few of the townspeople started picking up the bundles of bills and putting them back into the bag. Slipping his rifle back into its sheath, Smoke dismounted and stood by. The sheriff came walking up to him.
Mister, I reckon the town owes you a debt of thanks. Not many people would have taken hand in this, especially being if they were strangers in town.
Believe me, Sheriff, I had no intention of taking part. I just rode into a town, and all of a sudden, I sort of found myself right in the middle of a bank robbery.
The name's Bryant. Gary Bryant. I'm the sheriff here.
I'm Smoke Jensen.
Well, Mr. Jensen, you have quite a reputation. I don't know what brings you to Frisco, but I have to say that the town couldn't be any luckier than to have someone with your reputation at this exact time.
I hope you mean my reputation in a positive way.
Although it had been many years earlier, and all the Dodgers had been pulled, there was a time when there were hundreds, if not thousands, of wanted posters out for Smoke. These posters, some of which still turned up from time to time, had often put Smoke in difficult situations. With the law, he could generally talk his way out simply by having them send a wire to check up on him. It was a different story with the bounty hunters, though. Most regulators didn't care whether the reward posters were valid or not, and many had no plans to take him alive. It was their modus operandi to bring their subjects back in belly down across their horses. Smoke had found it necessary to shoot himself out of those situations on more than one occasion.
I know any dodges on you have long since been pulled off. Sheriff Carson back in Big Rock is a friend of mine, and unless he was lying to me, not only you not a wanted man, you are one of his full-time deputies, as well as a part-time justice of the peace.
Unpaid deputy, unpaid justice of the peace, and both positions are more or less honorary, you might say, though, to be truthful, I'm fully empowered to perform and have performed the duties of both offices.
Well, anytime you'd like to be an honorary and fully empowered deputy for Frisco, you just let me know. And I mean that in all sincerity.
I appreciate that.
What brings you to our town, Mr. Jensen?
I'm here on business, Sheriff. I'm looking for a man named Byron Davenport. Do you have any idea where I can find him?
Ah, so your business is with the cattle buyer from Chicago, is it?
Yes. I want to arrange to sell him some cattle. So I thought I'd look him up before I had my dinner.
I'll tell you what to do, Mr. Jensen. Why don't you just mosey on down to Mama Lou's cafe for dinner? It's right down the street here, a real nice place. Order anything you want and tell Mama Lou that I said the town was going to pay for it. And while you're having your dinner, I'll look up Mr. Davenport and bring him to you. I said the city will pay for your meal, and we will. But truth to tell, seeing as most of the money you saved today was his, that is, belonging to the company he's with, why, I reckon Mr. Davenport will be so glad to see you that he would more than be willing to pay for the meal his own self.
Thanks. Give me a minute or two before you bring him to the restaurant, will you? Just long enough to get my horse taken care of.
Tell McGee over at the livery that the town will pay for the boarding of your horse as well.
Sheriff Bryant started out to find the man Smoke had come to see. Mama Lou's was typical of many of the cafes Smoke had seen over the years. It was located in a building that was 30 feet by 40 feet. There was a counter painted green that ran three-quarters of the way down the left side of the room. Out on the wide plank floor sat a dozen or more round tables, while along the back wall were two very long tables that could seat at least 10 people each. Behind the green counter there was a blackboard, upon which a sign written in chalk advertised the day's fare.
Let's see. Special today. Ham, butter beans, mashed potatoes, 25 cents. Cherry pie, 5 cents.
A rather large woman wearing an apron over her rose-colored dress was wiping the counter with a damp cloth.
Just take a seat anywhere, honey. Somebody will be with you in a minute.
Thanks.
Although a few customers nodded and smiled, no one spoke to him. As he sat down, he saw one of the patrons get up from the table and move over to the counter and say something to the large woman. Both the customer and Mama Lou looked in his direction. Then the woman nodded, put down the towel, and came over to talk to him.
Oh, I'm Mama Lou. I want to thank you for what you done for the town a while ago.
No thanks are needed. I just suddenly found myself in the middle and had to do what I did in order to stay alive.
Oh, well, whatever the reason was that you stood up to them, the point is you did stand up to them. That means the town owes you thanks. And to express that thanks, I'm pleased to tell you that your dinner is on the house.
Well, I appreciate that, Miss Mama Lou.
Would you like a cup of coffee while you wait?
Yes, thank you. A cup of coffee would be very nice.
Do you want any of the fixings with it? Sugar, cream?
No, I'll take it black, please.
Well, black it is, cowboy.
In a few moments, Mama Lou brought the coffee herself.
Here is your coffee, Mr. Jensen. And if you want more, just let me know. There is a lot more where that came from.
Thank you.
Mama Lou was just walking back from the table when Smoke saw Sheriff Bryant and a very round, very bald man step in through the front door. Unlike Bryant's denims and plaid shirt, indeed unlike the clothes of anyone else in the cafe, the bald man was wearing a three-piece suit, brown in color, with a green bow tie. Brian pointed to Smoke's table, and with a nod to the sheriff, the round, bald man came toward him as the sheriff walked over to the counter to say hello to Mama Lou.
You'd be Smoke Jensen, would you?
I am.
Well, I'm Byron Davenport. I understand from the sheriff that you have some cattle to sell?
Yes, sir, Mr. Davenport. I surely do have some cattle for sale. Would you join me for dinner?
Well, thank you. I've had my dinner, but I'll sit with you if you don't mind.
I don't mind a bit. Please, have a chair.
Thanks. First, let me thank you for thwarting the bank robbery. The money you saved belonged to my partners and me, and I don't mind telling you, it would have been disastrous if we'd lost it.
Before Smoke could respond, Mama Lou brought his dinner out and put it on the table.
Oh, here, let me pay for that. It's the least I can do.
Oh, it's all been taken care of.
You don't say.
The sheriff said he wanted to pay for it, but I told him his money was no good here. Mr. Jensen's dinner is on the house.
My, you seem to be a popular man, Mr. Jensen, and rightly so.
If I could just bank all these offers to buy my meal, I could eat free for a couple of days.
Where are your cattle, Mr. Jensen? Are they nearby?
They're at my ranch.
I see. And how long would it take you to get the beeves from your ranch to the railhead here in Frisco?
I could have them here within a week. My ranch Sugarloaf is very near Big Rock.
Big Rock? Interesting that you'd come here, Mr. Jensen. I know that there's a railhead at Big Rock, and there's a cattle processing company that will buy your cattle there.
Yes, there is. But I'm gambling on getting a better price from you by bringing the beef here. And, seeing as you've just signed a contract to provide the Army with beef to give to the Indians, I'm sure you're in the market.
You're right about that. To be honest, I may have bitten off more than I can chew with that Army contract. But I'll say this for you. If you understand that, then you are a good businessman, because that means you've done your homework.
I don't want to fly under false colors here. I must confess that it was my wife who did the homework. Sally read about it in a newspaper and suggested I come down here to see you.
Did she now? Well, having a smart wife is almost as good as being smart yourself. How many head of cattle do you run on your ranch?
On my ranch? Ooh. I have around 30,000 on the hoof.
Whew. Mr. Jensen, I must say, that is a very substantial operation. In fact, I don't believe I've ever dealt with anyone who had such a large herd. How many were you planning on bringing to Frisco? Not the whole herd, I hope.
I thought I would bring about 1,500 head. I've only two cowboys to help me with the drive over here. 1,500 head is about the maximum I can handle.
Good, good. 1,500 I can handle. And what if I said $30 a head? How would that sound to you?
That sounds good to me. In fact, it sounds very good.
Thank you. I thought you might like that. Also, Mr. Jensen, I do have to be honest with you. I know that the top price being offered by the Red Cliff Processing Company, which is who would handle cattle coming through Big Rock, is only $25 a head. I offered you my top price, which is $30, to see if you would try to hold me up for more. If you had done that, I would have walked away from the deal. But you didn't, which means you're an honest man, and I like doing business with honest men.
Yes, I like dealing with honest men as well.
1,500 head, $30 a head. Have your cows here 1 week from today, Mr. Jensen, and I'll present you with a bank-certified draft for $45,000.
I'll be here.
Are you ready for your cherry pie, Mr. Jensen?
Yes, thank you. A piece of pie would be nice.
Ooh, cherry pie, you say? Well, I have eaten my dinner, but there's always room for a piece of pie. If you don't mind, Miss Mama Lou, would you bring me a piece as well? And maybe you could put some whipped cream on top of the pie? Oh, and bring me a cup of coffee with sugar and lots of cream.
I'd be happy to.
Some folks like to conduct business over a drink, but I say give me a good piece of freshly baked pie any time, and I'm just real easy to do business with.
I hope you never have to do business with my wife.
Oh, and why is that?
Because she's the smartest business person I've ever known, and she's the best cook I've ever known. I think that would be a dangerous combination for you.
Oh, I think you're right, my friend. I think you are right.
Reese Van Arnt was standing in front of the undertaker's shop, replaying the events of the day. The bank robbery had been his idea. He was the one who had recruited the men, and he was the one who had made the plans. He didn't personally take part in the robbery because being an albino meant he'd be too easily identified. Even if he tied a handkerchief around the lower part of his face, he could still be identified. Van Arnt held his hands out and looked at them, wondering, perhaps for the millionth time in his life, why he had been so cursed. His plan would have gone off without a hitch had it not been for the fact that it occurred at the same moment Smoke Jensen happened to be riding into town. Van Arnt knew all about Smoke Jensen, and had even had a run-in with him once. Van Arnt and his gang had stopped the train by the simple expedient of building a fire in the middle of the track. Of course, there was always the chance that the engineer wouldn't stop. He might get suspicious and plow on through the fire. So to back up the fire, they had built up a pile of rocks and logs sufficient to derail the train. Van Arnt would take whatever was on the express car. Then he would send a couple of men through the passenger cars to relieve the travelers of any money they might be carrying with them. His mind was brought back to the situation at hand as the train put on its brakes.
She's backing down, Van Arnt.
The train came to a complete stop about 10 yards shy of the burning pile and sat there. Van Arnt could see the engineer, backlit from within the cab, lean through the window to look ahead.
Get up there! Get up there and blow the express door!
The three men with Van Arnt rode up to the train. One of them put a stick of dynamite into the jamb of the express door. Then the three rode away quickly to avoid the blast. Van Arnt was so distracted by watching his men work that he didn't notice someone step out from the rear of the train.
Throw off the money pouch or we'll kill you too!
Van Arnt saw the money pouch being tossed from the train. A bullet plowed into the lead robber's chest. The money pouch lay on the ground beside him.
Muley, get the money pouch and let's get out of here!
One of the other riders leaned over to pick up the money pouch. The bullet caught Muley in his elbow, leaving his arm dangling loosely from a few ragged tendons. Muley rode off, leaving the money sack where it lay.
Van Arnt, I seen the muzzle flash. He's on the...
Van Arnt hesitated for a long moment, trying to decide whether to make a try for the money pouch or to turn and run. He hesitated too long, because he suddenly felt his horse go down under him, tossing him to the ground. By the time he stood up, half a dozen armed men were running toward him from the train.
Put your hands up, mister. Now!
Van Arnt had no choice but to respond. He was taken prisoner and put into the baggage car, and after the track was cleared, taken to the nearest town, where he was turned over to the sheriff. It wasn't until his trial that Van Arnt learned who the man was who climbed onto the top of the train to stop the robbery. It was Smoke Jensen, and Van Arnt's run-in with him wound up costing him 5 years in prison. The events of today represented the second time Jensen had spoiled one of Van Arnt's robbery attempts. Also, by a strange coincidence, the second time it had gotten his partners killed. It was too bad Van Arnt didn't know Smoke Jensen was coming to town today. If he had known, he would have made plans to ambush the son of a bitch and kill him. Over at the Railroad Hotel, Smoke Jensen went to bed with the satisfaction of knowing that his trip had been successful. 1 week from now, he would deliver 1,500 head of cattle to the loading pens here in Frisco, Colorado. Despite the fact that Smoke had been engaged in a life-and-death struggle earlier in the day, his conscience was clear and he drifted off into a peaceful, non-dreaming sleep. Van Arnt went to the hotel late that night. Glancing back toward the front desk, he saw that the night clerk was sitting in a chair, but the chair was tipped back against the wall and the occupant's eyes were closed. Van Arnt started toward the stairs, then stopped and walked back over to the desk. Making certain the clerk was still asleep, Van Arnt turned the registration book around and ran his pasty white finger down the list of names. If Smoke Jensen was still in town, it was likely that he'd be staying here at this very hotel, since this was the only place where lodging could be secured. He drummed his fingers lightly on the registration book for a moment, then saw an envelope lying on a table behind the desk. The name on the envelope was Smoke Jensen. Van Arnt smiled. Checking the guest named Kirby Jensen again, Van Arnt saw that he was upstairs in room 6. By a fortuitous coincidence, Van Arnt was right next door in room 4. Behind the counter was a board filled with hooks. Each hook had a key, or in case the room wasn't occupied, two keys. Moving as quietly as he could, Van Arnt leaned over the counter and lifted the key from the hook for room number 6.
If you aren't the right one, I'm sorry, but I don't intend to take any chances. I'm gonna kill you whether you are Smoke Jensen or not.
With the key in hand, Van Arnt went up the stairs to the second floor. The hallway ran down between facing doors. Even number rooms were situated on the left, while odd number rooms ran down the right side. The hallway was illuminated by half a dozen wall-mounted kerosene lanterns, all of which hissed as they burned. From two of them, little coils of black smoke worked up through the chimney. The doors to each of the rooms were painted brown, the rooms identified by the brass numbers that were attached to the middle of the upper frame. The hall was partially carpeted by a long, narrow rug that ran down the middle of it, leaving approximately 6 inches of uncarpeted and unfinished wood to either side. The runner was wine-colored and decorated with woven baskets of flowers and fruit. A roach was crawling along the unpainted wooden floor beside the rug, and as Van Arnt approached, it scurried through the gap under the door of room number 5. As he moved up the hallway approaching room 6, the one that he believed to be occupied by Smoke Jensen, Van Arnt reached up to extinguish each of the lanterns, causing the shadows to grow longer. By the time he reached room number 6, the hallway was dark, except for the ambient light of the moon that spilled in through the open window at the end of the hall. The window allowed for a slight breeze to cool the hallway. He stopped in front of the door to room 6. Smoke was sound asleep, dreaming of Sally and Sugarloaf, when something penetrated his dreams. Something that was amiss. He opened his eyes and lay in the darkness for just a moment, wondering what it was that had awakened him. Then he felt a slight change in air pressure, and he looked toward the door. Because the room was dark in front and the hallway dark behind, he could see nothing, but he sensed that the door had just opened. Smoke rolled off the bed and onto the floor. He heard the assailant turn and run up the hallway. Quickly, Smoke was on his feet with his gun in his hand. Stepping out into the hallway, he strained to see into the black maw, but he could see nothing. By now, other doors were opening as people, many of them holding flickering candles or brighter lanterns, and all in their night clothes, were sticking their heads out to see what was going on. Smoke stared into the darkness, but could see nothing. One of the people who had come out into the hall to have a look around was Byron Davenport, the cattle buyer.
Are you all right, Mr. Jensen?
Smoke realized then that he was the only one holding a gun. He lowered it.
I'm fine. You know, what was the shooting about? Do you know?
Yeah, I know. Someone was trying to kill me.
Who?
I don't know who it was. I don't even know why.
The hotel clerk came on the scene, having clambered quickly up the stairs when he heard the gunshots.
What's going on here?
Someone tried to kill this man.
What happened to the hall lanterns? Why are they out?
You're worried about hall lanterns when someone tried to murder one of your guests?
I have to relight them. Does anyone have a match?
Mr. Jensen, you take care of yourself. If you get killed, who will I give that $45,000 to?
$45,000? You're giving him $45,000?
Oh, yeah. But not until he delivers 1,500 head of cattle.
Van Arnt had been able to get away before Smoke saw him because his own room was next door to Smoke's room, and he'd managed to get inside before Smoke reached the hallway. Now he stayed in his own room with the door shut and listened to the conversation in the hallway.
$45,000?
Van Arnt looked at his pistol, then slipped it back into his holster.
Damn. I'm glad I didn't kill you, Jensen. Turns out you're worth more alive than you are dead.
Van Arnt took off his boots, shirt, and trousers and crawled into bed. Now he lay there with his hands behind his head, staring up at the moon shadows on the ceiling.
You're gonna have all that money. The question is, how am I gonna take it from you?
All who saw Sugarloaf Ranch agreed that its location in the Eagle River Basin provided one of the most beautiful landscapes imaginable. Creeks, springs, wetlands, lakes, prairies, and mountains. It was here that Smoke Jensen had established his 100,000-acre ranch, a huge spread traversed by 14 miles of the Frying Pan River, plus a handful of smaller streams. Its vast expanse of prairie, pools of water, and meandering creek bottoms easily supported his herd of some 30,000 cows, plus a rich wildlife population, including one of the highest densities of pronghorn in North America. Its sweeping vistas captivated all who visited Sugarloaf, and from many locations on the ranch, there was an unobstructed view of a 120-mile panorama of the Rockies, including the Sawatch and the Mosquito Ranges, through which the Denver and Rio Grande Railroad traversed by way of Tennessee Pass. Sugarloaf, like all ranches in the area, had two levels of employees. There were the cowboys who drifted from place to place, finding work during roundup and branding time, then leaving as soon as they were paid off so they could drift on as they preferred. There were also those permanent employees who were required for the day-to-day operation of the ranch year-round. To such men fell the task of riding and repairing fence lines, feeding the herds when snow covered the ground, and keeping the outbuildings in good repair. These were quite often settled men with wives and children to support. There were 10 such full-time employees at Sugarloaf, nearly all of whom were Mexican. Smoke's wife, Sally, was his full-time partner in managing the ranch, and on those occasions when Smoke had to be gone, Sally was perfectly capable of running the ranch by herself. Those who had known Smoke for a long time fully appreciated the impact marrying Sally had had on his life. Growing up in New Hampshire, Sally was from a family of great wealth. She could have stayed in New Hampshire and married well, meaning she could have married a blue blood from one of New Hampshire's old, established, and wealthy families. She would have hosted teas and garden parties and grown old to become a New England matriarch. But while such a future promised a life of ease and tranquility, that wasn't what Sally had in mind. She envisioned a much more active, some might suggest uncertain, future. Thus, she announced to one and all that she intended to leave New Hampshire. It was in Barrie that she met a young gunman named Buck West. There was something about the young man that caught her attention right away. It wasn't just the fact that he was ruggedly handsome, nor was it the fact that, despite his cool demeanor, he went out of his way to be respectful to her. That respect, Sally saw, applied to all women, including soiled doves, even though he was not a habitué of their services. But it was the intensity of the young man that appealed to Sally, a brooding essence that ran deep into his soul. Then she learned that his name wasn't even Buck West, it was Smoke Jensen. And the intensity was from the hurt he felt as the result of a personal tragedy of enormous magnitude. Smoke's young wife, Nicole, had been raped, tortured, murdered, and scalped by men whose evil knew no bounds. They had also murdered Arthur, his infant son. Those same men owned ranches and mines around the town of Barrie. In fact, one might say they owned Barrie itself, including nearly every resident of the town. If there was a Sodom and Gomorrah in America, it was Barrie, Idaho Territory. And like the biblical cities of Sin, Barrie was destroyed. But not by God, by Smoke Jensen, who, after allowing the women and children to leave, killed the murderers and the gunmen, and then put a torch to the town. When Smoke, with Sally now by his side, set out en route to the High Lonesome, there was nothing remaining of Barrie but the smoldering rubble of a destroyed town and the dead killers he had left behind him. The rage that had burned at his soul was gone, and he had put Nicole and Arthur to rest in a private compartment of his heart. With the fire in his gut gone, Smoke was free to love once more, and to be loved, and Sally was there for him. Smoke asked Sally to marry him, and she accepted, knowing from the depth of her soul that it was the right thing for her to do. Even before Sally met and married Smoke, her public teaching career had come to an end due to her refusal to kowtow to the evil directors of the town of Barrie. But she still had the call. Because of that call, and the fact that Sugarloaf was far enough from town so as to make it difficult for the children of the ranch to attend public school, Sally started a private and fully accredited school on the ranch. There she taught the children of the employees.
Senora Sally, look what I have made for you.
Smiling broadly, the girl held out a small piece of cloth upon which was embroidered a red flower, perched upon a green stem and encircled by green leaves.
Why, Maria, that is absolutely lovely.
It is a handkerchief.
I can see it is a handkerchief, and I've never seen one more beautiful.
It is not as beautiful as the dress you bought for me, but I wanted to give you something in return.
What are you talking about? It is every bit as beautiful as the dress. Haven't you ever heard the expression, beauty is in the eye of the beholder?
No, Signora.
Well, call that your lesson for today. It means that something is as beautiful as you believe it to be. And I believe this handkerchief to be one of the most beautiful things I have ever seen.
I'm glad you feel that way. It makes me happy to know that you like it.
Have you been studying your lessons?
Sally cast a glance at the girl's mother, Consuela.
Si, Signora. Maria has studied very hard. Her father and I are very proud of her.
As indeed you should be proud of her. Maria is a very smart little girl. Why, someday she could grow up to be President of the United States.
But she is Mexican, Señora. She cannot be President of America.
No, Mama. I am American. I was born in this country. But I can't be President because I am a girl. And a girl cannot be President. Girls cannot even vote.
Well, you tripped me up on that one. I had no idea you had studied your civics lessons so well.
But I think maybe someday girls will be able to vote. I think girls should be able to vote. Don't you?
Yes, I do think so. And I think you're right. I believe the day will come when women will be able to vote.
So maybe someday I can be president after all. And you can be my vice president.
Señora Jensen, I think maybe Maria will come to live with you if her father and I will let her.
Sally knew that she was not supposed to have favorites, but she was particularly fond of Maria, who was, she believed, the smartest and most talented of all the children in her school. Marion Smoke might have ended Sally's public teaching career, but it did not end her acquisition of new experiences and adventures. Indeed, she had already packed more experiences into her young life than most other women would have in three lifetimes. Being Mrs. Smoke Jensen carried certain responsibilities, not only as the wife of a successful rancher, but also as someone who could cope with the many and varied activities of a man like Smoke. Learning from Smoke, Sally was an excellent shot, a skilled rider, and a good tracker. Sally was also an excellent cook whose specialty was bear sign, a donut-type confection that was a particular favorite of Pearlie's. In fact, Sally's pastries had earned such a reputation that cowboys who worked seasonally for Sugarloaf had carried stories of them to other ranches. As a result, travelers sometimes rode out of their way just on the chance that Sally had recently turned out a batch.
What are you talking about?
The loud voice caused Sally and the others to look over toward the bunkhouse, where she saw Pearlie and Cal just exiting.
You know what I'm talking about. I'm just saying don't you be embarrassing me none now, that's all.
A few years earlier, Pearlie had been a gunman, hired by a man who wanted to run Smoke off so he could ride roughshod over those who were left. But Pearlie didn't take to killing and looting from innocent people, so he quit his job, stopping by not only to tell Smoke that he was leaving, but also to warn him of the trouble that lay ahead. That was when Smoke offered to hire him. Since that time, he had worked for Smoke and Sally. Pearlie stood just a shade less than 6 feet tall, was lean as a willow branch, and had a face tanned the color of an old saddle, and a head of wild, unruly black hair. His eyes were mischievous, and he was quick to smile and joke, but underneath his slapstick demeanor was a man that was as hard as iron, snake-quick with a gun, and as loyal as they come to his friends. Not too long after Pearlie had joined the ranch, a starving and destitute cow, who was barely in his teens at the time, made the mistake of trying to hold up Sally. Sally, who was nearly as good with a gun as Smoke, easily got the drop on Cal. But instead of turning him over to the sheriff, she brought him home and made him one of the family, along with Pearlie. Now, Calvin Woods was not only loyal for life to Smoke and Sally, but he'd become Pearlie's best friend and protege.
Well, I don't know what you're talking about when you say don't embarrass you. How could I embarrass you?
By standing around at the dance like some dimwit when all the pretty girls are just waiting for you to ask them to dance.
What? How's that gonna embarrass you?
'Cause I'm responsible for you. Folks will think I'm not doing my job, that I haven't taught you anything. It's bad for my reputation to see you just standing on the side with that hangdog look on your face.
I'm just always afraid that none of them girls are gonna want to dance with me.
Well, who can blame them? Standing around with a sour expression on your face all the time? Why, it makes you so ugly that one look at you would make a train take 5 miles of dirt road.
I don't think Cal is ugly. Do you think he is ugly, Senora Sally?
No, not at all.
By now, Pearlie and Cal had reached the front stoop of the main house where Maria and her mother had been talking to Sally.
Are you still my girlfriend, Maria?
See?
And you're gonna wait until I'm old enough to get married so you can marry me?
Senor Cal, you are old enough to be married. I am the one who is not old enough.
Oh, yeah, that's right, isn't it? I always seem to get that mixed up.
Wait a minute. What do you mean you're gonna marry Cal? I thought you were going to marry me when you grew up.
Oh, no, Senor. I cannot marry you. Senorita Lucy is going to marry you.
Ha! She has your number.
At that moment, Sally looked up, then smiled broadly as she saw a familiar figure riding through the arched gate.
It's Smoke!
Smoke urged his horse into a trot, then reaching her, dismounted. Embracing his wife, Smoke kissed her.
Smoke, you want us all to turn our backs so you and Sally can have a little privacy?
Nah, you can watch if you want to. Maybe you'll learn something.
Well, just so's you don't get embarrassed or anything.
What are you two boys all gussied up for?
Then Smoke saw Maria.
I knew it. Got a young, pretty girl on the ranch, and none of my cowboys will work. Are these men bothering you, Maria? Because if they are, I'll fire both of them.
No, Senor, don't fire them!
You're right. Can't fire both of them. Who would do the work? I tell you what. I'll just fire one of them. You can pick the one you want to keep around.
Senor!
Smoke, don't tease her like that.
All right, you win. I can't fire them anyway. All my other cowboys are gone, and I'll need the two of them to help me drive some cattle into the railhead at Frisco.
You got the deal?
Yes. It worked out just as you said it would, Sally. He's taking 1,500 head, and for $5 more per head than we could get in Big Rock. That means we'll be able to give everyone a bonus and still have enough left over to pay off the mortgage on the land we bought last year.
Oh, Smoke, that's wonderful.
It's going to be a long drive, especially with just these two worthless cowboys to help me. But it's worth it.
When are we leaving?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow?
At first light.
First light? Come on, Smoke. Me and Cal are going into town for the dance tonight. Night'll just be getting started at first light.
You're going into Big Rock, aren't you?
Yes, ma'am.
What do you mean the night will just be getting started at first light? You know as well as I do that they roll up the sidewalks at 10 o'clock in Big Rock.
Well, yes, ma'am, I reckon they do, but just in case they don't, why, me and Cal's got to be ready.
It's Cal and I.
Sally, when are you going to learn that trying to teach these two worthless cowboys anything is a waste of your time? Stay in town as long as you want.
That's more like it.
As long as you're back here, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, by first light in the morning.
Bushy-tailed? Senor Cal, Senor Pearlie, do you really have bushy tails?
I don't have a bushy tail, but Cal does. He has a tail just like a squirrel.
Maria's eyes opened wider, and she put her hand over her mouth.
He's teasing you, child.
Oh, I am glad. I do not think I would like Senor Cal to have a tail like a squirrel.
Come on, Cal. You want to stand around here and gab or go into town and have us some fun?
Pearlie started toward the barn to saddle his horse.
I'm coming!
Good Lord, look at them. They'll be dead in their saddles tomorrow. Like as not, I'll wind up leading their horses and herding the cattle myself.
Don't give them a hard time, Smoke. Don't you remember what it was like to be young?
Do I remember? What kind of question is that? I'm still young. But if you have trouble remembering, just ask me, and I'll tell you what it's like.
Oh, you!
Smoke retreated into the house, and Sally started to go after him, but realized that Maria was still standing at the foot of the steps. She turned back to the little girl.
Maria, thank you again for the beautiful handkerchief.
You're welcome.
Consuela, tell Carlos to take extra good care of Smoke's horse tonight. It brought us good news.
Si, senora.
Sally watched young Maria and her mother walk away, then turned to go into the house after Smoke. She had in mind a very special welcome home. Every Saturday night, the Morning Star Hotel in Big Rock held a dance. The ballroom of the hotel was brightly lit with hanging chandeliers and wall-sconce lanterns, and approximately 24 young men and women were milling about, waiting for the music to begin. Pearly and Cal saw a couple of friends from Twin Peaks Ranch and went over to talk to them.
Cal, wherever did you get that hat?
What's wrong with the hat?
What's wrong with it? Look at it.
I am looking at it. I don't see anything.
That's it.
What's it? For the life of me, Mo, I don't see anything.
Like I said, that's it.
Mo, if you don't tell me what the hell you are talking about and tell me quick, I'm gonna go right upside your head.
Look at my hat. Do you see any difference?
Cal's hat was black. Mo's was brown. Cal shook his head.
Yours is brown.
Pearly, ain't you learned this young pup nothing? Look at the hat band, Cal. What do you see?
You got one of leather and turquoise?
Uh-huh. And what do you have?
Well, I don't have a hat band.
That's my point. You want to show off to the girls, you need to get yourself sharpened up a bit. Maybe a red kerchief or a silver belt buckle or a hat band like this.
How much does something like that cost?
What do you care? You work for Smoke Jensen, don't you?
Yeah, but what does that have to do with it?
Well, hell, he's one of the richest men in the state. Surely he pays you enough to be able to buy a hat band.
I think you should get a silver hat band.
Looking toward the sound of the voice, Cal saw Lucy Goodnature.
Do you really think so?
Absolutely. What do you think, Pearly? Don't you think our young friend should have a silver hat band?
Yep, I think you should have a silver hat band.
How come you never said anything like that before?
Yeah, I guess I never thought of it.
Ha! The only reason you're saying it now is because Miss Lucy said it and you're so crazy about her, you'll do anything she says.
Cal!
Lucy smiled, obviously pleased by the way the conversation was going. Just then the music started, and Pearly and Lucy went to dance. They stayed on the dance floor for quite a while. When one of the dances was nearing the end, Cal looked toward Lucy.
Hey, get away from me!
A tall, lanky cowboy was reaching for her, and he saw Lucy draw back from him. It was Lucas Keno.
Just because you're the daughter of a ranch owner don't mean you're too good for an ordinary cowboy.
You being a cowboy has nothing to do with it. I don't want to dance with you because I don't like you.
Yeah? Well, you've come to the dance, and that means you're supposed to be willing to dance with anyone who asks you to dance. So I'm asking, and you're going to dance with me whether you want to or not.
Lucy, I believe you had promised me this dance.
Pearly walked up to her.
Yes, yes. I had promised this dance to you. I was afraid you'd forgotten.
Oh, no way I'd forget something like that.
Like hell you're gonna dance with her.
Once more, he reached out to grab Lucy by the shoulder, this time pulling her forcefully away from Pearly. Pearly offered Lucy his arm, and they started to walk away from the cowboy. The others at the dance, thinking the episode was over, also turned their attention away from the cowboy as they prepared for the next dance.
You son of a bitch. I've had about enough of you.
He's got a gun.
So have I. And my gun is cocked.
Keno's thumb was on the hammer of his pistol, but he hadn't yet pulled it back.
Keno, if your thumb so much as makes one little twitch, I'm gonna blow your brains out.
This ain't your fight.
Oh, you mean the one between you and Pearly when he knocked you on your ass? You're right, that one wasn't my fight, but this one is. This one is just between you and me.
Keno's face broke out in perspiration, and slowly he lowered his pistol.
I don't want no trouble.
I'll tell you what. Best way to avoid any more trouble now would be for you to just put your pistol on the floor, then leave.
I ain't putting my pistol on the floor.
Have it your way, Keno. I'll just kill you. Then you and your pistol will wind up on the floor.
No. Wait.
Put it on the floor and walk away from it.
The cowboy did as instructed, and Cal walked over to retrieve the pistol. He took out all the bullets, then stepped to the front door and threw the pistol as far as he could out into the night.
Show's over, folks. Band leader, play us some music. You want to dance again?
We could do that. Or we could take a walk. Don't you think it's awfully hot in here?
Oh, I don't know that it's that hot.
Tell me, Pearly, just how hard is it to get you to take a hint? Can't you tell when a girl is asking you to take her for a walk?
I guess I'm being a little dense. Miss Lucy Goodnature, might I have the pleasure of your company for a stroll around town?
You may indeed, sir.